Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author.
Today's investors expect more than a transaction. They want a relationship. Show how your firm merges EQ and IQ with Orion's BFI 20, a new shareable assessment developed by Dr. Daniel Crosby that provides you with emotional and attitudinal insights into clients to facilitate more meaningful investing conversations from day one. Get started today at orion.com/BFI20.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby, and today I'm joined by Kelsey Willick, writer at Not Your Boyfriend's Investment Advice and founder of the Aura Finance app, an app which I wish I had built. She's here today to discuss the intersection of wealth and wellness. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, it's great to finally meet you. So you're doing something that I think is fascinating. I mean, quite transparently, the first time I came across it, I was like, yep, wish I had done this, wish I had built this. I think it's much needed, but it's not the kind of thing that you go to the trouble of building without a why, without a story or without a purpose behind. So I'm interested in learning more about your journey and hearing about the spark that led you to want to start Aura.
Yeah, definitely. So I'll kind of go back to the beginning. I studied entrepreneurship and English in college, and after that graduated with a ton of student debt and massive financial anxiety. And I had no idea how to even get to a net worth of zero. There was a moment in my life where I took every piece of article of clothing I had owned, threw it out of my drawers, and was crying about how I feel completely worthless. And it was such an embarrassing moment for me where I was sitting alone, really. I didn't feel like I could share my experience with anyone because no one had felt like what I had been going through, although that's highly untrue. People don't talk about money. And if you feel like you need to, oftentimes something holds you back, whether it's embarrassment or you don't think you know how to ask the right or wrong questions. And flash forward, I ended up getting an opportunity to work for Goldman Sachs, which I'm so thankful of that opportunity. And I had had a colleague that I had shared that situation, what was going on with me. And she was the one that really taught me the power of working smarter, not harder, and told me, you know, refinance your student loans and invest the rest. And in turn, I was counteracting my student loan interest rate, building wealth while also paying off debt. And it really set me up for success in the future. And what I also ultimately realized was investing isn't really that hard, but getting in the mindset to invest is. And so while I was at Goldman, I really wanted to help expand access points for other people to get started investing, particularly young women. I had some of my best and brightest colleagues who were not only not invested at all, oftentimes would come up with excuses like, you know, this is my job. I don't have time to do it for myself. I couldn't imagine what was going on in the broader ecosystem. So decided to leave the firm after 6 years and joined a program called On Deck, which is a founder's program all about going from zero to one. And I met my now co-founder, Courtney Cardin, who at the time was working on a Duolingo for financial literacy. Her long story short was she was a lawyer. She was married to a wealth advisor, ended up getting divorced in her early 30s and realizing she had never truly, you know, had autonomy over her financial decision making. And so I wanted to help get specifically women educated around finance. And we realized we were kind of trying to tackle the problem in different ways. We wanted to create a more inclusive financial system. I was looking at how do I create and make access points more accessible? She was looking into how do I help improve financial literacy? And we ended up doing a research project together and realizing this isn't really a problem of access or education. We live in a time where it's so easy to get started. We have completely, you know, quote unquote, democratized the system. Financial education is everywhere, but we don't talk about mindset. We don't talk about the emotional side of money. And that's why Courtney and I teamed up and joined forces to build something that did.
So fantastic. So it's fascinating because I really do think of it as the Duolingo of financial education to this day. And we're going to talk about some of the elements of it. You know, Aura is a mindful money management platform that has the explicit aim of helping people invest and manage money in a less anxiety-inducing way. And I love what you said earlier. I hope I don't misquote you here, but I love what you said. In, you know, investing isn't hard, but getting in the right mind frame to invest is. Why is it so important to help people get in the right mindset, and how do we begin to do it?
Yeah, so I think it's a Warren Buffett quote that's getting good at finance has little to do with how much you know and more to do with how much you behave. But in the world of finance, we've created this massive facade that has everything to do with how much you know. I even remember when I was back in school, I learned how to pick a stock before I learned anything about personal finance. And that's like teaching someone the genetic breakdown of their food before teaching them the basics of how to eat healthy. Right. So Aura talks about mindset first. And we talk to our customers about how money makes them feel and their relationship to it. And we do it in a number of ways, some of which are helping you take a money personality assessment. Although cheesy, we say things like, you know, the only way to write your next chapter is learning your story in the first place. We also have a mindfulness scale. We sought out to define what does financial mindfulness even mean? And we've defined it as how accepting and aware of your financial situation you are. So you could be someone that checks your bank account every single day. So you might be high on awareness, but low on acceptance. Or you might be someone that pays your credit card bill off every month, but has no idea how much you actually spend. You would be high on acceptance, low on awareness. So we want to bring mindfulness back to the conversation. And the reason that this is more scientifically rooted is most people make their decisions from places of fear and anxiety. It's no secret that millennials and Gen Z are more anxious about the world more than ever, and money is the leading cause of their stress and anxiety. And when you're stressed, you can oftentimes make irrational decisions, which can often lead to overspending, underinvesting, and poor financial choices. I was even talking to a friend the other day who was telling me about how she had about $15 in her bank account, yet she was going to buy a $15 smoothie. It's almost like we live in a world where people are so negative. They have this, you know, mindset of why would I try in the first place? And the cycle of stress repeats itself. So our mission at Aura is to really help improve your relationship to money and mindset so you can truly make better decisions, one from a place of abundance over scarcity, and in scientific terms, the parasympathetic versus the sympathetic.
Yeah. Getting as specific as you're able, what are some of the specific features of the app that sort of promote this mindfulness? You talked about the personality assessment and the mindfulness scale. What else are you doing to sort of help facilitate this mission of yours?
Yeah. So I'd say one of the ways in which we do that is how we invest. So there's a quote, the best investment plan is the one you can stick with. But at Aura, we believe the one you can stick with is the one that you believe in. And that's why our investment tools are all about aligning your investments with those values. So rather than putting you in a number of ETFs, we build you an index fund, which basically means we are allowing you to choose what is going into that ETF. At Aura, we call it your index fund. And so if a customer doesn't want to be invested in oil and gas or tobacco or wants to be more heavily weighted in climate activism, they can do that. And when customers feel better about where their money is going, they're more likely to achieve the goal that they have sought. They're more likely to share and be proud of what they're invested in. And so that's definitely one of the ways that we think about it. Other things that we're doing are we're really trying to look into how do we ask typical finance questions in different ways that actually help people define what they think their version of a rich life looks like. So in a typical finance app, it'll ask you, what's your goal? Right? Like, is your goal to have a home? Is your goal to have a family? Is it to build wealth? We're working on, although not fully deployed yet on the app, we're working on how do we redefine, how do we ask that question in ways like, what's your why? Which feels sometimes like a jarring question to be asked, but we live in the society of vision boarding and people asking questions around what is their version of a rich life, which might be defined very differently from your parents' generation. And we're asking them those questions.
So you're creating direct indexes then. Do you use it? It's direct indexing technology that has sort of an ESG, socially responsible component to it. And you're using positive and negative screens on the social side of things. Is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah, it's interesting. I you know, longtime listeners of this show will know that I'm somewhat cynical about the benefits of ESG from sort of a social impact standpoint. but very high on the benefits of ESG from a behavioral standpoint. Mm-hmm. I believe that one of the most powerful things about ESG is that it makes it more real for people. It makes it more vivid and more personal. And so I'm really on board with this idea of sort of personalizing the index en route to helping them stay the course. You know, I want to talk for a minute about gamification, because my wife is about as moderate and temperate a person as you would ever meet. I mean, she has a wonderful personality. She's very calm, very, very great with kids, all of these things. But she is maniacal when it comes to Duolingo. And I saw her get wrapped up in her Duolingo streaks and become consumed by her Duolingo streaks in a way that I've never seen anything else consume her. Your own app has badges and different gamified elements. And I think it's fascinating because Aura is using gamification to try and reduce anxiety, promote education, and things like that. Whereas some of the other dominant players in the space are using gamification to sort of appeal to our worst behavioral impulses. Can you talk about how you have tried to be thoughtful about the gamification process in a way that brings out the best and sort of minimizes the worst?
Yes, definitely. And it's funny that you bring up Duolingo like that, because I watch Courtney absolutely obsess over it too. I think she's on some crazy streak of maybe 600 days or something. And it's how do we bring fun back to finance? Because for so many people, it's this, you know, black box. It doesn't feel engaging. For oftentimes when we're first talking to our customers, we just self-describe as a wealth engagement platform over a wealth management platform, because we've found that many set and forget apps actually completely take out the mindfulness of what you're doing with your money, and they haven't really helped from a financial anxiety. So that's our why. When it comes to how do we ensure that we are being thoughtful and not causing harm to our investors, it goes back to our business model and what we've designed around. So when we think about a classic, I won't mention them because I think we all know the big companies that do gamification that often harm customers, but what they're oftentimes designing around might be things like day trading, which is, as we well know, harmful to customers. And at Aura, we're a subscription-based model. We are not incentivized by you to come back on a daily basis or to trade on a daily basis. We are incentivized to help you feel better about money and to build wealth. So all of our gamification is around how do we get you to a place of comfort making your investments? How do we get you to a place of comfort doing exercises on the app that will benefit you? One of those exercises is something we call our Saving and Investing Optimizer. It helps you learn how to save, spend, and invest your paycheck based on the 50-30-20 rule. And you have to be mindful about it. You have to input what your actual expenses are. You can even go through it as a coach if you'd like to, but we will reward you for taking those actions, which we see as a tool to help our customers actually make good choices. And when it comes to the education base, a lot of people say they want to be educated when it comes to financial literacy, but there's something holding them back, and we know that. And so how we can deliver that education in more bite-sized, engaging ways is the way we actually get them to learn, rather than inundate them with content that might feel like is something that's more of a necessary evil than something that's fun to return to, is our entire mission.
Yeah. One of the other features of the app that I thought was great was a community feature. And one of the things that I noticed is that you actually have people self-report their job title and their current income. And I mean, that made me, I'll be honest, made me gasp a little bit, because it's pretty unusual in a day and age where talking about money is still pretty taboo. What's the thought about having a community general for this sort of enterprise, in general for this sort of enterprise? And then specifically, talk to me about your thoughtfulness around having people self-report their income and things of that.
I'm going to caveat this feature is not available to everyone yet, because we're really experimenting. How do we introduce it in the right way? On the back end, as we have been intentional around it, we have been building around a double opt-in. So this isn't something we're going to force you to do, but if you want to see what others are doing, you have to share yourself. I think LinkedIn did a really wonderful job at that. But we really want to demystify the conversation around money. And how you demystify that conversation is by having conversations and narratives and telling people what like-minded folks are doing. what I found really interesting in all of the conversations, and I even found it via my blog, was people most of the time take investment advice from their friends, families, significant others. They aren't necessarily turning to professionals. They want to know what others like them are doing. So we want to promote those conversations within the app, allow people to see what others are doing. Not being said, not in the sense of this person made this trade, but rather this person set this goal. This is how much money they're making. We haven't even thought yet, are we going to show how close that person is to achieving the goal? But we do want them to know that they're not alone here and that they have can have these conversations with people about money. Because if you don't talk about it, then you're much less likely to take action. I think specifically, although we're a gender agnostic app, a lot of the people that come to us oftentimes are women that haven't been invited into the conversation, although they're deeply curious. And that's even shown true in companies like Refinery29. I think they've done a brilliant job showing how people spend their money. Like they'll do a day in the life of someone that's 29 making $120,000 in New York City as a marketing professional. People obsess over those articles because they want to learn about others. We are a communal species. We are deeply curious. And so that's one way we can help get people feeling like they're a part of a community that they're deserving to be in and one they don't feel alone in.
You know, one of, you know, as a psychologist, I know the power of social proof. And I think, again, trying not to name names here, but I think many of the other apps who have gamified social aspects of our financial lives have done it in the most meaningless and in some ways harmful ways, right? Like, let's see what other people are day trading. Like, that's not helpful. That, like, that promotes our worst impulses. And even down to, like, you know, showing, like, oh, you know, Tim paid Sue back for a latte or what. It's just sort of innate. But it gives sort of the feeling of authenticity or that feeling of self-disclosure, but none of the real meat. So I applaud you for what you're doing here about trying to share and publicize meaningful parts of our financial lives that will engender meaningful conversations and good behavior on the part of the people who observe it and not the inverse.
That goes back to what are you designing around? We'll always have to think of what is your business and business model incentivizing. And if it is doing something like a credit card swipe, or if it's doing something like a day trade, it misaligns oftentimes with what is my intention? How do I actually benefit the customer? And so that's why, like, we have a subscription that is so clear in the sense of we're not trying to get more out of you. You will get everything out of this clear price, and everything else is we hope to deliver up to that. But we're not even trying to get you to invest more even. And of course we want you to build wealth, but that's not how we win, because we don't want to be creating practices that might not benefit you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to turn with our last couple of questions. I want to turn to your writing. One article you wrote that really kind of blew my mind touches on some of the doom and gloom that attends the conversation around younger generations and their money. You write in your article that on an inflation-adjusted average, baby boomers paid $148,000 for their houses versus $347,000 today on average, which is ouch. You know, you also talk about how minimum wage is about 26% lower today than it was back then on a real basis. And yet you ultimately maintain a positive tone in that article and say that all is not lost. What hope do young people have in the face of these sort of stark realities?
Yeah, I think, so the whole reason I wrote that article was I was at a dinner in Christmas time, sitting around a table, and it was this stark contrast between Gen Z and millennials talking to their parents' generation and how, pardon my language, all the Gen Z and millennials were saying, we're absolutely effed. Like, there is no way we'll be able to live the quality of life if you guys, you just don't understand. And then there was this weird moment, though, where the parents said, you guys just talked about how you were at a Michelin star restaurant for the past, every single week for the past month. And it got me thinking about how do I really dig deeper into what's really going on? And I'm not saying that I don't think that millennials and Gen Z have it difficult. Like, the numbers speak for themselves. We are in a difficult space. But I don't think telling people, woe is me, everything is difficult, is the way we solve the problem. We're basically finding this in social media, and I'm seeing this across the board when it comes to talking to our customers. When you tell someone they're totally screwed, they're just going to think, well, if I'm screwed, I'm not going to do anything anyway differently. But if you approach the conversation from a perspective of, hey, you might actually be okay, I think that's where we can make real change. And letting people know the progress that has been made is a part of that narrative. So, for instance, I talk in this article about how access to real estate is possible through technology. Although it might not be the ideal means, you're probably not putting a $10,000 down payment on a house like your parents were. The bar might be much, much higher. But if we can teach people about tools like Fundrise, for instance, that can help you incrementally get to where you want to go rather than not taking an action in the first place. Another meaningful conversation I had with someone recently was, you know, I had been talking to them about retirement, and they said, well, I'll be dead before I'll need that anyway, because they had such climate doom and felt like the world was in such a state of dread. They felt this existential crisis. And yet the funny thing was, I had also talked to them about their skincare routine, and they are indeed taking care of their skin today, which has everything to do with their skin in the future and not aging. And I wondered why. And it's funny that the industry, when it comes to hair care and skincare, is such a place of positivity. So people do it. So how do we have this perspective when it comes to finance? Again, not ignoring the realities, but having I want to bring a voice of, we are going to be okay if we make some changes in our life. And our mindset is a massive part of that.
Yeah, it's such a fine line to walk. And I think you walked it quite nicely in your article, because, you know, on the one hand, we have this concept in psychology of learned helplessness, right? Like, if we do believe we're screwed, and we internalize that message, and we hear it again and again, we don't even set out to try in the first place. But I don't think the answer is to be excessively Pollyanna-ish either, or to ignore the realities about the ways in which younger people have in some cases gotten a raw deal. So yeah, I think as professionals, as an industry, we have to be honest about the reality on the ground, but also ultimately keep an optimistic tone. And I think you did that nicely in your article. You know, I'll talk about one more piece, and we can link people to your blog at the end here. But you wrote a nice piece on behavioral finance, which of course I loved, and you broke down behavioral finance into four sort of major parts. You talked about self-deception, heuristic simplification, social influence, and emotion. The last three were, I think, 250 episodes into this podcast. I think we've talked about the last three quite a lot. But I'm curious about the self-deception piece. You know, both how you avoid it and think about it in your own life, and as someone who's a founder building a choice architecture for thousands of other people to steer their own financial lives. So talk to me about self-deception and how you try and think about it and avoid it.
I think to begin, I'll have to say, I don't think you necessarily avoid it. I think you acknowledge it. Like, I am a human. I'm not a robot, and I don't intend to be. And I also lead with, I don't know everything. And that's, I think, what makes us and our team and myself excel in how we navigate conversations with customers. Because oftentimes when the conversation around money is often, I know everything, listen to me, you're dumb, therefore you should abdicate control to me. And I think it's highly problematic. When it comes to self-deception, I used to do all of my investing on my own. And I used to manage it on a monthly basis. I didn't want to pay fees and whatnot. Although obviously, as I was investing in many ETFs, I would find myself making irrational decisions constantly. And so I would forget to do certain things, or when I would go to make my investments, had noticed that certain things had dropped, even though I had set a plan and I wouldn't stick with them. I would even make highly irrational decisions because colleagues at the time were telling me, this is the new company that you need to be investing in. And as a human, it's so easy to jump on a hype train. Mm. And so the way I have helped myself is, I'm building a company for also myself. I use our products and services. I use our direct indexing strategy. We use our algorithms to invest rather than make those decisions on a daily basis. And that's how I avoid the self-deception component. But again, I have to highly recognize that the whole point of self-deception and everything around bias and implicit bias is by recognizing you're not fully going to solve it. You can only recognize that you're susceptible to it.
Yeah. No, it's the truth. Blind spot bias is real, and we're all susceptible to it. All we can do is remain humble, try and put ourselves in a good spot. Kelsey, what you've built is fantastic. If people want to learn more about it, where can they find out more about you, your writing, and also the company, of course?
Yes, definitely. So you can find us at aurafinance.io. We're currently in a private beta, but you can request early access directly on our website. You can also follow us on Instagram. We're just aura_finance, and TikTok, same name. And you can also find my blog, Not Your Boyfriend's Investment Advice, on Substack.
Kelsey, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such a fun time.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.